Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming. We're fortunate to have with us today. I'm Ian James, first of all, from the Desert Sun in Palm Springs. And our discussion today will be about climate change, conflicts, and displaced people. And we have with us Hannah Fairfield, who's the climate editor at the New York Times, Beth Murphy, who is the director of Ground Truth Films, and Jeff DeBelko from Ohio University, a professor and the director of the Environmental Studies program there. And so I wanted to bring out in this discussion, you know, these stories of people who are displaced by climate change are so important. They can be complicated to tell. There are stories that have been unfolding in the past several years in Alaska, in Louisiana, in places like Somalia and China, and most recently in Puerto Rico. So how can we tell these important stories? How can we do it well? How can we communicate the complexity in cases where climate change is stacked on a number of other complicating factors like weak institutions and other conflicts that are that have broken out in these countries? So that's what I want to focus on today. And we'll look forward to your questions during the last half hour or so. So I'd like to start with Beth Murphy and to introduce her work, a short film about Somalia.
Oh, thanks so much, Ian. Thanks for putting this panel together, and thanks everybody for being here. So at the Ground Truth Project, we've really made it a priority to, an editorial priority to focus on environmental reporting. And we've been working on, for the past about a year and a half now, on a series called Living Proof, The Human Toll of Climate Change. And we've done a lot of multimedia reporting around that. My part of it is to make, and in some cases oversee, the making of five short films that specifically look at the impact of climate change on women and children. And we've been filming in Somalia, Afghanistan, Puerto Rico, the Marshall Islands, and in the South Bronx. So this is one of this is a portion of, we've cut it down for the presentation, the full-length version of Climate for Conflict, which was shot in Somalia by two incredible journalists that we've been supporting for the past 18 months, Laura Heaton and Nicole Sebecki. And we're taking this film to film festivals and having it be part of some other editorial work. It's on the website of Foreign Policy Magazine, where there was also a long written article. We also partnered with ABC News Nightline for a shortened news package using this same material, created a podcast with it as well. So we're trying to reach as many people as we can and in many different ways as possible. With different kind of versions of the story, kind of, you know, reframing it and reshaping it for the different audiences. So I'm very happy to share this with you today. Again, this is Climate for Conflict is the title of this piece.
Weather pattern is going to create the fastest growing desert in the world.
We have seen dry valleys, big dry valleys. The livelihood of Somali people is entirely attached to the water and the land. You can imagine how fragile that is.
Climate change is linked to conflict in Somalia. Well, Somalia is not really the reason for this impact of climate change, but we are paying the price for that.
With this weather pattern, Somalia or Somalis will not survive. A piece of desert called Somalia will exist on the map of the world, but Somalis cannot survive. We'll eat each other alive because this environment is not giving us anymore.
Rob guban bay wax ku deeyeen baan na yiri guban kaan imanayna ableel baan ugu imanay ableelkiina waa naga iska baaba'ayno duuga la yiraaha yaa wax duugtay haddaad magaceega doonayso duuga waxaa la yidhaahaa ee dhammeeya dee abaarta inay dad iyo dunyaba haaqayso yaanu malaynaynaa dad iyo dunyaba inay haaqayso dunyadii way dhammaysay dadkana inay daba kaxayso
shan iyo afartankaa sannadood abaartaa maanta dhacday ee xoolo naga dhammaysay nolosha daciif bay garaysa markaa waxaa la yidhi ninkaan cuud lahayn ninkaan dunyada lahayn doog waa abaar ninka haddii dunyada ka dhammaata xoolo ka dhammaadaan xeeladan adhigu dee intan uu kale u baxay labadaa geedo waxay ahaayeen dee geedo ilaahay bixiye bay ahaayeen har kolkay lahaayeen roobku da-o daad baa laagta mari jiray markii hore bar iyo hore lamaanaan garaac jiray waan daynay xoolo arsan jiray oo dadka arsan jiray ciyaalka arsan jiray laakiin waxaa dhacday geedii inaan nagu kaliftay abaarta dheeraateed kuwii hore ka siyaadii markay dhacday qoys tahay ead moogta xoolo kaa dhammaadaan abaarna kugu dhacdo nolosha cidi ka gasho waxay ku kulifaysaa inaad ciyaalka ku masaarifayso
everybody wants to cut burn and think about what they can get today but nobody is looking forward and saying what will happen in the next 20 years
Charcoal production induces desertification and deforestation. The kids that are farmers will lose their jobs, and because they lose their jobs, they become radical. That is the conflict environment nexus.
dhibaato badan aanan la kulmin kuli hor aanan waa idinku sheegay 27 maalin dhexda kusoo juray dhexdadan waa nagu qabsadeen oo nimanka u shabaabkahay shan maalina meel nagu hasteen oo gaarigii oo barkaddan soo baxayni waa diidanayeen in oo inta loo soo guuro isguuridkii waxaa zaa-id uu sii daranba sidii abaarhii oo kale ninka dii asoo dhergan naftiisa oo ama lagu dilay ama lagu xiray hata waxba kaa dhibaysa laakiin nin baanuna baahidiisii taasaa kusii darnaatay
macnaha waxa weyaan waxaan rajaynaya waxaan filayaa inaan nololba inaanan jirin haddii ay taasi ila muuqata aniga soomaaliya ama manaha afrikaba
Very powerful work, and want to give Beth a chance to talk about that, but we'll do that a little bit later. And we also have a video from the New York Times, primarily from the series Carbon's Casualties, about people displaced by climate change in places from Alaska to China. So I'd like to ask Hannah to talk a bit about that project and how it got started.
Sure. Well, in our newsroom in the beginning of last year, a bunch of editors sat around, just like a bunch of editors sit around in your newsrooms, and thought about what was the kind of some of the major themes that they really wanted to push on for the year. And a few of us said climate refugees are an issue that we feel like has been undercovered, and can we think of strong ways to bring that in front of a wide audience to show the incredible urgency that we as editors in the newsroom were really feeling. And what we settled on was a series that had six different correspondents, both domestic and international, but we wanted a unifying theme, and that unifying theme we decided would be the visuals. So we had one photographer who fortunately was also a drone operator, and we were able to send him with the six different correspondents so that visually you got a real sense that this was a singular theme. So this is not a video per se, this is a reel of the drone footage. What I wanted to do is to show you all of the places that we were able to go and just get kind of a quick sense of it. That's a little girl named Gia Lee, and this is her backyard.
Thank you.
constantly moving.
Striking. So I wanted to start off by asking, how did you decide on the places to go and how to tell these stories and on the visual approach that you would take?
Well, fortunately, we trusted our climate and environmental journalists. So we sent out basically a kind of call to a lot of the correspondents and said, if you think where you are right now has a really interesting climate refugee story, let's start talking about what that might look like. And as you can see, a lot of the correspondents said, it's incredibly urgent, it's happening right where I am, and this is the kind of story that I want to tell from this place. And we were able to, fortunately, figure out which ones were going to be the ones that felt the most urgent and the most powerful. We really wanted to tell important stories from China, simply because of the vast and amount of people that was affecting, and the speed at which the deserts are growing. We felt like there's just an incredible urgency there. The Chinese government is moving millions of people and will continue to. And so we did two stories from China. As you could see, one was from the edge of the desert, and then one was from the city where people had been moved. And the correspondents were excited to tell these stories, and they were really excited to tell them in a really visual way. Once we had identified that Josh Hayner, who's a Pulitzer-winning photographer, was going to be the signature visual theme throughout, he was instrumental in helping to find the right areas and figure out the right way to tell those stories. So he had a drone with him in almost all of the cases, and he worked enormously closely with the correspondents to find the kind of angles and visuals and sort of emotional pieces of this story that we really wanted to tell. And we published them all throughout the year. So this was a big project that was last year, and it was nominated for an Emmy this year, which was lovely.
And as you talked about the series as it was developing, what were you looking for in each place? Was it specifically, let's find the places where there are people who are experiencing the impacts right now?
Very much so. This series to me was all about the people whose lives were being dramatically affected. Many of the other climate pieces that we focus on are geography or science or politics, but this series was about people. It was about their stories. You saw their faces, you saw them right up close, you heard their voices. It was really important that we allow our readers to see those people. And we wanted this to have real reach. We translated the story set in Bolivia into Spanish, and the two stories set in China, we translated those into China and made sure that the people from those countries also had real access to what they were seeing within their countries.
And Beth, tell us a bit about the Somalia project and how that got started. And
sure.
What were some of the challenges, too? It's not an easy place to work, right?
No, not at all. I mean, similarly, it was very important for us to have a very character-driven story being told, and it was very important in the film, at least, that all of the voices in the film are Somali voices, and to really demonstrate that, you know, I think a lot of times when climate change is talked about and stories are done, it often is framed as a story for the future. You know, if we don't take action by, you know, next year, then by, you know, 2050, X will happen. And we really wanted to show the audience that this is the real problem right now for the people in Somalia and has been, and that this is kind of, you know, the canary in the coal mine for the rest of the world. And if we can understand what's happening there, we can really, you know, understand what the future is going to look like for a lot more places. The editorial starting point is that the journalists found out about a UNDP study out of Kenya that was being done to look at how people in Somalia were adapting to climate change, and that was, you know, really interesting to look at that. And it was a prerequisite for Somalia being able to apply for and receive international environmental funds. And so in the course of kind of tracking that story, they came across the story of this British researcher, scientist, ecologist, Dr. Murray Watson, who had done the only comprehensive land survey of Somalia back in the 1980s. And there were, they found out, tens of thousands of old photographs that he had actually smuggled out of the country before the Civil War, and they were all in a farmhouse in the UK. And got in touch with Dr. Watson's family, tracked those photographs, and thought, wouldn't it be cool if we could look at the photographs of this, you know, incredible land survey that he had done and go back to some of those same places and see what things look like today? And they, you know, we didn't know what would be found. Would it be dramatic? Wouldn't it be dramatic? And in fact, one of the things that you would see in the foreign policy magazine piece is this diptych photo series where you see the Dr. Watson photo and then you see the Today photo next to it, and it is, you know, alarming the difference in the landscape and what has happened over this essentially short period of time. And you know, Dr. Watson also, the story you know, gets into the climate, you know, conflict nexus. He was kidnapped by extremists in 2008 while doing more land survey work in Somalia, and he and his Somali engineer that he was working with have never been heard from again.
Well, and Somalia is one of those cases where climate change is, together with all these other factors that complicate the situation, right? The lack of institutions that sort of hold the country together, as well as this, you know, a country that's already kind of on the edge of water scarcity, and then climate change comes along and makes that more complicated. One of the questions I wanted to ask Jeff is, you know, how can journalists look at the complexity of these issues and tell these stories fully when, you know, there may be many pushes and pulls that are involved in a decision of a person or a community to move or to be relocated?
Right. Yeah, well, I think the two examples we saw show that these really complex dynamics can be told in a really nuanced, dramatic, striking fashion that is true to that complexity. I think that is, however, if I won't say an exception, but it is exceptional because it's really difficult to do. Because exactly as you say, the issues we're talking about, climate change, conflict, and migration, all just taken alone are highly complex. And then particularly when we start mixing them, it gets even more so, which given the amount of space you have and the need for headlines and the need for and the desire to use narrative to tell stories, is then kind of can get in the way and be difficult to do. But I would say that while trying to do this, that it's actually, there are ways to do it and that embraces that complexity and has it work for you rather than something you have to try to reflect and then get muddled. And so in that sense, it is, it's an opportunity even for those who don't have the resources or the ground knowledge or the context to go to these far away places. So for example, to look at immigrant communities in your different locales and find that, and that's, you know, that's a standard way to try to tell an international story with a domestic context at a regional newspaper, but, you know, make it a climate adaptation story, right? Those folks are sending money home to somebody, right? There's a remittances strategy, and in that sense, they are helping those folks back at home who these pictures we've seen really need help, but adapt in ways that are perhaps not really kind of overcoming and making everything okay, but still giving them agency, lowering their vulnerability, giving them choices so when they do have to move, they can do that with a higher degree of intentionality. And to me, that's then reflects some of the complexity that's behind it, avoids the understandable, but I would say too narrow view of these people as just victims. Right. If moving is a rational strategy to environmental change, then let's make that easier for them by changing our labor laws and changing the way we move money and understanding that those folks in our community here in the U.S. are tied to these people and give us an opportunity to tell those complex stories.
Right. And it also strikes me that there are a number of policy stories to be told about, you know, for instance, in Alaska, what are the funding resources that are available to help these communities? What is the international community's response to refugee flows and, you know, in places like Kenya? And it seems like in a lot of these places, you know, we play a really important role in putting these stories on the public agenda and generating more discussion about them because there really hasn't been preparation for this, right? Yeah. Would any of you have thoughts about that?
Sure. I mean, one of the other stories that we followed as part of this series was focused on sex trafficking in the Philippines and the connection between climate change there and the 2013 typhoon. And, you know, what they found is, you know, within the 3 months following that typhoon, there were about 5,000 women and children, they estimate, who were forced into trafficking directly related to this climate event, and it was the first time that the International Organization for Migration, post a climate event, set up an anti-trafficking unit, and so that was a unique, you know, international response to a crisis. And I think, you know, for us, you know, and kind of thinking about, you know, editorially the stories to follow, we were trying to, you know, look for stories where there were these unexpected human consequences, and that was one that really seemed just really, you know, so heartbreaking and dramatic, and that these climate events create these environments in which it's much easier for these, you know, bad actors to operate, and where it's much harder to crack down on that kind of activity.
And another important point, I think, is that a number of people who do move are displaced internally. So a lot of the migration that may be related to climate change is happening within national borders. And would you have some thoughts on how we can cover stories like Puerto Rico and what's likely to play out there in the next months and years?
I think that is actually a very, very fascinating question. Certainly within the United States, the pieces that we focused on in Louisiana and Alaska, those people who are being displaced are going elsewhere in the United States. And certainly that's a smaller scale than perhaps what we're seeing in Puerto Rico right now, but that's going to be a very urgent question. We're going to see this these moments in time where extreme storms or extreme weather events really cause major upheaval in certain areas, a whole island potentially being erased, and there will need to be political decisions made very, very quickly in a way that they're not very quickly happening necessarily in Alaska, where the question of relocation funds has been up for debate for 10 years and very little has actually been done. But those questions are really important that we all cover them. We cover them quickly and we put them in front of people because there are millions of people's lives at stake.
And I wanted to ask all of you if you have thoughts on how we can do more of this coverage in a time when, for all news organizations, the funding is limited. And maybe data is a part of that?
It's a good question and a hard question. We were fortunate to be able to send Josh Hayner, the photographer, to many of these areas. But much of the most dramatic work was done actually in the office in New York by people who didn't travel at all, and that was looking at the satellite imagery of these areas. We are so fortunate now to have such wide accessibility to data and to satellite data, and you can look at you know, from your desk, you can look at places over time. And so that the lake that I showed you, where the fisherman and his beached boat behind him, one of the most dramatic pieces of that story was simply looking at the satellite imagery over time. And in a very short period of time, a single decade, you saw the lake go from being the second largest lake in Bolivia to being absolutely nothing, to be completely dried up. And that was just a merging of satellite images that we were able to put together. So there are things that we can do in our newsrooms that don't necessitate a really wide variety of travel. There is also the sort of data accessibility around the world. When we were looking at the China story, looking at the growth of deserts, that also was able to be tracked through data. And we looked at levels of windstorms, and we also looked at the satellite imagery to be able to identify exactly where we wanted to go. So there's more tools now that we have, I feel like, in the past 10 years, and that means that we get to tell, you know, more vibrant, more robust, and more data-focused stories.
Can I also add a couple additional ones? I think in some ways, still using narrative, but changing the focus of the lens to who cares about these stories for different reasons. So in that sense, not just on conflict, but also migration and connection to climate change, the security community really cares about it. And ironically, coming out of Washington, one of the few that are still paying attention to that. So I think anybody who has a military base or a security presence in their community has an avenue to have that conversation where it's through that lens. Why do they care? What does it mean for how they are responding to these kinds of places? And what are the concerns? What are the opportunities? And in that sense, it's a different protagonist. And there's a good and a bad and maybe even ugly dimension to those interests, but it gives another avenue. I think the other is flipping the script on vulnerability. We're now learning through, if we didn't know already, but through the Katrinas and the Sandys and now the recent spate, that we're actually really vulnerable too. And it may be hard, but we should remember that for the longest time, there's been a presumption, Bangladesh vulnerable and the rest of us are rich enough to build up a wall, metaphorically and literally. And that's clearly now not the case. And in fact, we have not just a lot to teach and share with others, but we have a lot to learn from others. And so the counterintuitive notion that we're more vulnerable than some of these other communities that we typically assume are the most, right? It's a different kind of vulnerability. But they're actually ahead of the game and have had to, because they're not wealthy, find ways to deal, ways that are going to be some perhaps really productive lessons in places like Puerto Rico and Houston and now perhaps again New Orleans with what's in the Bay this week.
Also on the, did you want to say something else, Beth?
No, go ahead.
How about it?
I was just thinking about the security connection, and I think, you know, anytime we can make that, you know, Somalia is the land of, you know, Black Hawk Down, and certainly people remember that, and, you know, why is it that, you know, security there matters to you if you're not leaving the United States? And, you know, we're seeing that in Afghanistan. I mean, we have a huge, you know, stake in what's happening in Afghanistan. It's our longest running war. And we've been doing a lot of filming there over the past, really since 2001, but most recently focused on what's happening with the climate-induced drought and how that's, you know, pushing more farmers to grow opium poppy because it's drought resistant and, you know, requires about 1/6 of the water that, you know, more traditional crops like wheat require. And so this is a real threat. And, you know, we talk a lot about threat multipliers, and certainly, you know, this is one, and there's, you know, we've got the insecurity, the climate change, lack of infrastructure, poor governance, you know, all of these things converging in places like Somalia, like Afghanistan, and where the impact to the United States is ultimately, you know, less secure, more terrorism, and more people drawn to terrorism. You know, in Afghanistan, the poppy farmers are, it's inevitable that they will become closer to extremism because the extremist groups are protecting and taxing the poppy growth. And so, you know, making hundreds of millions of dollars to fuel insurgencies inside and outside of the country. So the, you know, the military, you know, component of this is very real. And I think it's definitely a way for a more general audience sometimes to access the story and sort of, you know, understand the implications.
And some other examples would, of course, be Syria and Darfur, where, you know, climate change has added to this mix of other factors that that lead to conflicts, make them worse. And then, of course, there are also the local conflicts between, you know, maybe pastoralists, you know, and others who are, you know, looking for water sources in East Africa, for instance.
Yeah, and we definitely saw that in Somalia. In the longer piece, there's a young man who's killed over, you know, an intercommunal fight about a water source. And, you know, when, you know, the family's ready to take retaliation. And so it was a community where there, this kind of violence didn't exist before. And now that kind of violence is starting because as the water sources diminish, people are moving, you know, closer to each other and closer to these more limited water sources.
Can I say, perhaps obvious, but bears repeating since we've seen the kind of play out multiple times, one of the challenges of telling them these very real stories but complex stories is that we're sitting at the Society of Environmental Journalists as opposed to some other adjective around media. And part of it is that we have to engage with, maybe it's a different desks, and Hannah, you were saying different desks were interested in these topics, and that's positive. But part of the pitfall, we'll just kind of throw it out there, is when we privilege our adjective in front of any of these things, migration, conflict, refugees, and such, because they are complex, multiple dimensions. And we've seen and still have the scars for how, when those are oversimplified, there are real impacts, right? So Ban Ki-moon, when he's head of the UN, when he's the Secretary General, writes a Darfur op-ed that says, Darfur, first climate conflict or climate war, question mark. And in many ways, it was short, but it was relatively reasonable piece. But the humanitarian folks went nuts. Because they said, essentially, you have just let the Sudanese regime that's armed the Janjaweed off the hook by giving them an external explanation that we conveniently in the West are responsible for this climate problem, and we acknowledge that, for excuse for Darfur. Now, that may seem absurd, but boy, immediately it was the rhetoric, it was the pushback. And so in that sense, while these the kind of bumper sticker versions and the copy edited title that you get for the stories that you kind of really engage in this complexity, it really matters. And so in that sense, partnering and having that context, even if the headline doesn't give it, that is really important because there are, in fact, costs in terms of how we perceive it and how that framing is used.
Thank you. Is there anything else that the group would like to add before we go to questions? No, we're about at question time. So I would ask everyone who wants to ask a question, please stand up, state your name and your affiliation. We will go with SEJ members first, and I'll repeat the question because it's all being recorded. Yes, back there. So how are we doing in connecting stories about energy use in the States and where we are and in other places to these actual impacts elsewhere?
I'll take that one. I think that we're doing a better job than we used to. which doesn't mean that we don't have a long way to go. But I do think that in most of the coverage that that I've seen on impacts, which is really what we're talking about today, I see a strong theme in the acknowledgement that that human-induced climate change and the high level of carbon emittance are in fact connected. I can't speak for media outside of my own, but it's something that that we are constantly drawing the connection and making sure that all of the stories that we produce show that arc, so that the story is full, and you get for policy stories that you get some real perspective of that. And I think just to come back to what Jeff was talking about, there are many stories that we report on that I think probably 10 or 15 years ago we would not have mentioned the phrases climate change or global warming or refugees. And more, even though, as he said, it is a complex topic, the idea that this is an accelerant, that climate change is much of an accelerant for what we've seen, there's a strong acknowledgement in media now for that. And I think that that we continue to bring that in front of people and be able to tie those things together in a way that we don't oversimplify, but we do make those connections.
Yes. So the question is, the developed world has caused a lot of these problems and brought them upon the underdeveloped world. What do the participants think about the moral questions and how we're bringing out those moral issues in coverage?
Good. Yeah. So I think we're finding different ways of doing it with different stories, and sometimes it's not always perfect and it's not always a direct connection, but the piece that we have really made a decision where we are going to kind of focus more on this moral question is with it started off as a film. It's now become a multimedia project, which is a collaboration with Frontline, and it's called The Last Generation. It's in post-production right now. And where we're looking at, and it's going to be, very explicit in this piece, where the Marshall Islands, how they're suffering and how it's really a look at the children there and what they're living through and how they might be the last generation to grow up in the Marshall Islands. And, looking at, where they fall on the list of climate change contributors compared to where the U.S. is, and looking at also the history of, U.S. actions there and having done all the nuclear testing in and around the Marshall Islands, and how many people there were displaced already because of U.S. actions, and now here we are again, 50 years later, it's longer than that, but displacing this population yet again. And so, and I think because it's, it was important to us, I think, to see it through the eyes of children who are, so innocent and really just, speaking from the heart, and it's a way into the story and our moral responsibility, I think, that is... really just gets to the heart of it. I think you feel it from the kids more than from adult talking heads, and so that's I'm very proud of where that piece is going, and it should be out in the spring if you want to keep an eye out for it.
Just maybe circling back to that one idea of the immigrant community here and remittances, I think at the heart of it, challenging what is an appropriate climate change response. And so if part of we caused the problem, let's be part of a solution, even if we're not going to fundamentally deal with the momentum in the system that means the Marshall Islands is going to have real challenges from a sea level rise perspective. At the same time, Does it make sense to think of building a nursing facility in one of those islands that historically contributes nurses to the economy and making through labor mobility laws and remittances and moving money? That's a climate change response that we can help those people deal with the impacts, even if we're not kind of rolling it all back, and access to education. And so challenging what is perceived to be a climate response, broadening it out, and in some ways recognizing through helping economically, through education, through access, through immigration laws, then that to me is a way that we can start fundamentally addressing those people's livelihoods and conditions.
Yes, over here. So on the military angle and the threat multiplier issue, could we expand on that topic?
Sure. Some danger in answering a question that was at the heart of my dissertation suggests that it would go longer than you'd want. I think you can say that a big starting point, end of the Cold War, suddenly time to opportunity to look at issues that aren't new but newly considered in a security realm. So starting then, although then it was just environment, it wasn't climate until 06, 07 for a variety of reasons, there has been interest. We, from them and from our perception of them, it's been about does environment cause conflict? The kind of, in some ways, the wrong question, but that causality. It's become much broader. And in fact, to the point where the retired two-star Air Force general who was the head of the National Intelligence Council, so the kind of intelligence community's think tank that does assessments, told us on the kind of outside, you guys think we just care in the security community about what the conflict of the day and organized violence. If Cambodia only gets one rice harvest instead of two because of Chinese dam building and climate change impacts in the Tibetan Plateau, that matters to us in terms of understanding the fragility, stability of a key country given the food security dependence on the Tonle Sap River. I mean, he was down at kind of that level. And so in that respect, everything from the Somalias and what that means in terms of terror to larger questions like, again, this would be a challenge to write this piece and not get a lot of pushback, but they want to understand migration flows from Africa, South Asia, Middle East to Europe and what that means for rise of anti-immigrant parties and the crazy new reality, we'll call it, in European politics with the rise of right-wing anti-immigrant. They want to know what's going to happen in Europe. Is it the climate change causes Le Pen in France? No, that's absurd. Can you understand some of this without these migration flows? What's behind the people moving? Economic, sure, but it's more than that. And so in that sense, it's real. They're interested in lots of different things beyond kind of where they're, can you fly from Diego Garcia anymore as a key Air Force base? No, because it's not going to be there much longer. The Arctic, absolutely. I mean, they got a lot of ways they care.
There's an infrastructure question as well. I mean, nobody likes the word infrastructure, right? But it means money, and the military cares a lot about money. And the changes that we're seeing globally are expensive, and there's vulnerability on bases around the world, not just the United States, but Jeff just spoke to that. But that's, I think, where there's a real sense of awareness and urgency from the military that I think is a really interesting story.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll go here first, please.
Mark LaMonica from The Conversation. I just wanted to follow up on what you're saying, Hannah, when is this a climate story versus a weather story or an environment story? I mean, do you have a thought process where, yes,
so when is it a climate story versus when is it an extreme weather story?
Well, what we've learned in the past, I would say at least a decade, is that the connections between extreme weather and climate are direct. And so I think the distinction between this is weather and this is climate is something that we thought more about a few years ago. And now, because of those, because of the hurricanes that we've seen and the intensity that climate scientists tell us that because of warming oceans and warming air, that some of that intensity is directly connected. That I'm worried less, honestly, about making those distinctions, that scientists are finding connections between weather and climate in ways that we can draw on their research and bring that in front of people. So I think in part what I said before about more stories that might not have been identified as climate stories years ago now are climate stories. And I think the more that we can bring that in front of people, the more we increase our readers' awareness of how this touches all of our lives.
Yes, in the back.
Hi, my name is Donna. I'm a reporter in Maryland, and the area I cover is pretty rural. So whenever I write a climate change story, there's always this question in the back of my mind, which is a lot of our local politicians don't believe it's real, a lot of my audience don't believe it's real. So whenever I write a story, I'm just wondering, like, is that going to, like, I just feel like lots of people are just not going to read it. They either don't care or they don't want to hear about it. So how do I reach to that audience, you know, to make sure that I tell the story in an effective way that opens that line of communication, that keeps that line of communication open?
So how can we tell the story in an effective way, especially in areas where a number of the political leaders and the people who live in those areas don't buy the science?
I'll take it. it's a great question. It's a really important and urgent question. And honestly, I think that we can rely a lot on visuals to help us tell those stories, because you can see quite a bit of change in Maryland happening on the coastline, in people's backyards, erosion, increased storms, and being able to bring those in front of people, not in a way that makes it politically charged or lectures people or puts some distance between them, but simply to show people what is happening in their backyards, in their lives, I think is the best thing that we can possibly do.
Also, I think if you can find stories that have an economic impact angle, so people who are being, you know, hurt economically because of what's happening with climate events, that could be an interesting way in as well.
I think without suggesting at all, because I'm not avoiding the term climate change, I do think that it's in part it's not necessarily even the science. It's objecting to certain messengers and certain labels, and so finding an alternative label that still allows you to talk about the same issues and puts those in front. So how do we make our community less vulnerable and more resilient in the face of, gosh, we've had these extreme events. We don't want that to happen to us. Finding if there's a levy on building water infrastructure, asking hard questions about, are you assuming that the past water data is going to be a good predictor of what's going forward, or how are you changing your infrastructure decisions locally so that this lasts us the 100 years we need it to last? Of course, climate change is there, and that's what, and you can bring that in, but it's not leading with climate.
Okay, I'd like to go over to the second row here.
Hi, Adam Glenn. I'm a journalism educator and trainer, and I wonder if we could flip the advice that you're providing to primarily domestic U.S. journalists to journalists working in their home countries overseas to cover these issues, both because I think SEJ is explicitly making an effort to involve more foreign journalists in the organization, and also more selfishly, because this week I'm running a workshop for 4 dozen Nigerian journalists covering climate migration. What advice do I offer them to cover this in their country and more extensively in the world at large for all of them?
So what advice can be offered for people covering climate change in other countries?
And it's explicitly this migration security
and specifically migration and security issues related to climate change.
I've always got a take, but I'm trying to not talk too much.
Can I add something to this? Would it help?
Okay.
My name is Thiago. I'm a freelancer for National Geographic Brazil and founder of a startup Media in Brazil. And we did a story in the Amazon rainforest about extreme climate. And the difficulty would be to, because governments in countries such as Brazil and others, they can speak about climate change and say that they are fighting deforestation or stuff like that, but it's mostly bullshit. So that's a difficulty, I think, for reporters. And even if you are coming from the U.S. To cover extreme climate story in Brazil, that's something that you're going to face. So one way, I think, to do that is to find a way to put some pressure over local governments, even if it's different when a New York Times reporter is covering a story and making the publicity international. Because, okay, government in Brazil is fighting deforestation, not so much right now, but has fought it in the past, but there's no action against climate change.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
So I think the internal migration question that we talked about before is really an important one, though that data can be much more difficult to track. And so the people who are inside those countries who can see trends happening before they ever show up in the data or maybe never show up in the data, I think that's incredibly important. Moving from vulnerable places to less vulnerable places, the water question is a huge one in terms of driving not only conflict inside of countries, but also between countries. I think we're probably going to be seeing a lot more of that. But to my mind, where journalists who are inside the countries, who are on the ground, and who are living it, what they can do is see trends before we can see them by understanding the motivations of people who are moving around internally inside the country, and also the pressures and the political pressures that sort of pop up when those internal migrations occur.
Mm-hmm. I'd say I think having them think about when it makes sense to frame it as climate and when it makes sense to bring it down to water, agriculture, and the other places where these impacts are being felt. A lot of times, whether it's interviews with folks on the ground who have moved or government officials, climate change is down at the bottom. Some of that's because it's not a lack of awareness. Some of it's just because the immediate, it's perceived as longer term and the immediate day-to-day is higher on the list. So go with what's higher on the list as a way to bring those others in. I think partner with others who can access the data, the scientific, the fancier presentations, so that both reporting can be improved. And I think also look for what may be dismissed as, kind of rightly the cynical approach of, well, you signed on these international agreements. But at the same time, at least things like the National Climate Adaptation Plans filed for Paris have governments saying, these are our threats, these are what we're going to do, and such. And so they've signed it, they've filed those plans, then that gives the journalist something to say, well, we signed up for it, we're not doing it. And then it becomes a lack of performance, and you start to have some pressure for legitimacy and follow through. And where, there's a budget, you say you're doing this, and then you actually go to the place that they're supposed to be doing flood mitigation, and nothing's happening, right? You can tell that story.
Well, there are a lot of people are asking. So also in the first row, there's a question. Do you still have your question?
I was just going to ask specifically, getting back to the question of how do you get your rural readers in Maryland. I'm not here, I'm from the University of Montana. I've lived in Wyoming for a long time. And Jeff, you touched on just finding sources that are credible stakeholders for your readers that are maybe not the people we usually go to. And I was wondering, Hannah, if you guys have done any thinking about this, who are the non-traditional sources that resonate in communities that have rejected climate change over the last 20 years? Insurance folks are one of those sources that we've certainly found are audiences will listen to because they're already paying for anticipated climate changes in their insurance premiums going forward. Who else is out there who can carry this message to an audience that might reject it from other sources?
So who are some of the non-traditional sources that we can turn to in areas where there are large numbers of people who are skeptical of climate change?
I think the energy community and the energy grid and utilities are a really interesting place to look for that because there are many states where climate change is not right now, I think, in the forefront of their minds, certainly politically or legislatively at all. But they have really robust wind and solar energy grids. There are jobs there. There's infrastructure being built. And people who are living in those communities see that, and they can see how that affects their lives. And so reporting on that, getting through that message, the insurance agency community is also a really incredible one. But I see a lot of interesting reporting to be done on how the grid affects our lives everywhere, and it's not something we think about a lot. I think there's a lot to work with there, particularly in communities who don't spend a lot of time thinking about it, but where there are real growth in jobs is something that that is, in those states in particular, economically, is a real bright spot. And focusing on things like that can be incredibly useful.
I'd just like to add also that I've seen some really great reporting that your team has done on real estate and coastal real estate. Are there any tips in that area for sources that people can tap or ways of looking at that issue?
There's a lot of great real estate data, and I would definitely suggest anybody who's working on this beat to take a look at real estate data in their community, both from the insurance perspective and also looking at sales. It's a fun way, I think, to see trends in your community. And there's certainly been a lot of change in the past couple of years about people not buying coastal property as much as they used to, not just from the insurance perspective, but just because people don't want to live in a place that is vulnerable.
Okay, in the back.
Hi, I'm Renee Lurksman, and I'm a researcher. So I just want to follow on that theme around how do we communicate about climate in communities that don't seem open to it, and add on the importance of trusted messengers. So I've done some research on engaging with conservatives around energy and climate, and the main thing that does come up for within conservative rural communities is precisely what climate change represents, which is that it's obviously profoundly threatening for a number of reasons. So I don't necessarily think it's about showing how this affects your locality, because we know that that doesn't seem to really motivate people. But again, to recognize that the community of conservatives getting on board around climate energy is exponentially growing, but it's very underground. I don't know if any of you have been covering the DC meetings this past week.
Sorry, our time is really limited. Can I just ask you to get to the question?
Well, I'm just adding that there's conservatives amongst us that are very concerned about this, and it's our job to find those folks and find ways to give them more of a platform.
The Military Advisory Board is a great resource, I think. They have retired generals who go around the country, mostly in red states, and talk to people. So that could be an interesting way in, see where they will be speaking, and kind of, harness some of those stories. One of the things, I was really interested to kind of partner might be too strong, but essentially that to work with the Military Advisory Board and, you know, share some of our film work that they then, some of these speakers can take on the road with them to, you know, to share some of these stories in a visual way. And I think that's kind of, you know, an exciting opportunity to, you know, speak to people and not be preaching to the choir always. And so I would definitely recommend them.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I was just interested because, Hannah, you made the point earlier about how response has generally been pretty slow where this is being seen so far. And I'm curious if any of you in your response to displacement, I should say, if any of you in your reporting or research have seen places where local governments or national governments or nonprofits or whoever are actually, you know, proactively coming up with strategies for the future, putting funding together, or doing anything that really is significant.
So are there some examples of places where governments at a local level have been taking proactive responses to deal with these coming issues?
I would say China has really taken the lead in making some of those choices. They've built whole. I showed you some of the imagery from whole communities, millions of people that they moved from the desert into other areas. So that's certainly one way of making those decisions. Around the world, I haven't seen on that scale the same kind of government driven displacement, but I certainly do expect to see more. Beth, can you speak to? Do you know of any others in other countries?
The one that just came to mind is something on such a, it's relatively small scale, but it seemed kind of exciting. Something that's happening in Somalia. There are a lot of indigenous plants and trees that have either because of what's happened with the climate, they're either gone or they've changed so much over time, and so they have this enormous seed bank committed to replanting and reintroducing some of these species. Just kind of interesting to think about, and they are considering this a long-term strategy for dealing with climate change. But it's not at the kind of that scale of immigration.
It's an interesting question because it's also very policy driven. Because one of the reasons that people have to leave areas is because they can't grow food anymore.
Right.
It's just too hot and too dry to grow food. So one way that governments are making investments, as you just spoke to, is investing in research for seeds for plants that can be grown in areas that are fairly inhospitable. Yeah. And that allows people potentially to not move. But that is something that governments, particularly in the hot, dry regions, they are right now, we know, focusing on investments in those areas. So that's a little bit different than migration, but it's trying to reduce the necessity for as much internal migration.
Well, I feel like we could talk another hour, but we're out of time. So I just want to say a big thank you to our speakers who came for this, and thanks to all of you.